Tonight, I'd like to introduce Richie H., who was referred to us by Devin, who was awesome, so I'm very excited to hear from him. I know some of you know him, so I'd like everyone to give him a warm welcome.
Hi, everybody. My name is Richie. I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I'm glad Devin spent time with you guys. I love Devin. He's an amazing guy. And to that end, I don't know if he announced it when he was here, because I don't know if I missed it when you said any AA-related events, and it only occurred to me afterwards. Devin probably didn't have this to give when he was here, but Devin's actually doing this, and so I figured I'd throw it out. I don't know if anybody in here knows what Fellowship of the Spirit is. Fellowship of the Spirit started a long time ago out in Colorado. A guy named Don Pritz and a bunch of their people in AA, and they had a conference where they invited people to come. And you know, Joe and I were just at the Jersey Shore Roundup, and it's a kind of like that. But Fellowship of the Spirit was meant to be, you know, it's just a very spiritual. I mean, they all are, but it was a very spiritual undertaking for them, and so they invited people from all over to come and join them. And it became big. Word got out there. We, like, people from my home group would go fly out to Colorado, and people flew from all over the country. And then eventually people said, you know, I'd like to open a Fellowship of the Spirit with the same design, but I want to do it in Arizona. So they did one in Sedona. And then they opened up one in New York. And then they did one. And they do them all over the place now. I think they're in, like, I don't know, a dozen states or more where they have these conferences for people who are interested. And now they happen to be throwing one. Devin and some of the other guys they know the people out in Colorado, so they got the format and they decided to do one. And so they're doing Fellowship of the Spirit in New York. It's workshops, big book meetings, speaker panels, May 20th through May 22nd. It's in Stony Point, New York. Costs a little bit of dough. It's $370 for the whole weekend, right? So there's some meals included in that. It includes your lodging and includes everything else. So, but you have plenty of time to think about it now and put away a few bucks a week to save up the dough to go. It's way worth going to these. And it opens on Friday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it closes and is finished on Sunday at 3 in the afternoon. Arissa B. from Boston, Massachusetts. Brendan J. from McKinney, Texas. Marty C. from Hamilton, Ontario in Canada. Ralph W. from Los Angeles, California. And Vanessa M. from New York City are the five main presenters. And then there's all sorts of panels, which people who go, they may ask you, like, hey, you want to do a panel? And so that's kind of fun, too. So if anybody wants to know any more about it, you can always, you can come and see me, and I can text you this after, or my number's around, and I'm sure you can get it easily enough, and I'm happy to give it to whomever. But it's worth it, and I figured I should probably announce it since Deb was just here. So, my name is Richie. I'm definitely an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 24th, 1996. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. I sponsor guys. He sponsors guys. It's an important aspect of what we do. I was talking to Joe about that. I saw him this weekend, and we were chatting. And this has worked for me since I came in. I'm not sober 25 years by accident. I'm not the most well person in the room. I'm one of the sicker people in this room still to this day because, you know, I have that disease of alcoholism and probably other stuff too. And so I found early on going to these retreats helped me to stay sober for a number of years. And saying yes to all speaking commitments helped me to stay sober for years. Doing this big book and the work in this big book have helped me stay sober for years. And I've been able, lucky enough, to fell in with a group of people who talk this stuff and walk the walk and had the ability to sit down at a kitchen table, crack open the big book, and do the work out of the big book. You know, before I start and engage in, like, you know, I'm asked to come and present and do it big book study style, which I love to do. I could talk big book all day long. You know, what does that even mean for newcomers? We're asked to come and present and do a big book study. So every time I come to present, my main goal is to help a newcomer. Always. Anytime I go to a meeting, anytime I have to speak, my first thought is the newcomer. And anytime I work with someone at my home, you know, you come and you crack the book. We start at the cover page and we work our way through. I'd never ask you to do anything that wasn't in the book. And you can't disagree with anything I say because it's all what Alcoholics Anonymous says. It's what they, I don't ask you to do anything that I think you should do. Imagine if it was Richie's Anonymous, we'd all be dead. Trust me. I don't run things well. I'm not a good manager. But I always try and meet people where they're at rather than where I'm at, right? Anytime you're working with anyone. But doing a study that way is impossible. How do you meet everyone in a room where they're at? I don't know where everyone might be at. If you've never been through the book before, you've been through it a dozen times, you sponsor 50 people, you've never sponsored anybody, you're just getting ready, maybe you're in the middle of a fourth step. But it doesn't matter. The reminder is to identify, don't compare. We try and do that in qualifications, and there's no different the application of that mindset to a big book study, right? You can look and see for areas that do make sense to you. You know, some of us I've gotten better at this over the years because I've screwed so much up. It's unbelievable how many mistakes I've made in recovery. And from those mistakes comes growth. And so if you haven't made those mistakes yet, sometimes you can listen to people and you can avoid some of the bigger potholes. And then other times you just have to make your mistakes on your own. Point is, if you have a home group and a sponsor and spiritual self-examination and you use these tools, the mistakes don't need to derail you. It's simply something that you learn to grow from. And so we try and do that together. And that's why I love Big Book Workshops, because it's all ways for us. For a newcomer, maybe you'll hear some stuff that might interest you or make you, you know, ask a question. When I would do these, sometimes I'd write down questions to ask my sponsor afterwards. I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. I got to ask JOT about that. And every time I came to a study. And then hopefully, even people, if you said the set-aside prayer before we started, for the next few weeks as we do all this together, hopefully, I always remain teachable. And if you've been doing this for a long time, you may hear something where you're like, oh, you know, that's not a bad idea. Oh, that's pretty cool. Or I've never looked at it that way, or my sponsor never said that to me. I'm going to tell a lot of stories while we're here together. One just popped into my brain. So along those lines, the application of these steps. I'm a big where the rubber meets the road guy. So I was sponsoring a ton of guys. I moved to Richfield Park, New Jersey from Staten Island. I was sober maybe 5 years, 6 years at the time. And I sponsored. I was like unhealthily sponsoring. I don't know if you know what that means. There is a way for an addict and an alcoholic like me to tip the scales and even make spirituality a sickness. And I said yes to everyone, much to the dismay of my fiance at the time and my parents and my family, because guess what? I tilted so far into working with others that I took away from the other responsibilities for the family, which is one of the main chapters I'm going to cover with you guys, at least for tonight, is the family afterward. And so I didn't do the right thing by my family because it became too much. But on one of those days, I went to a sober apartment in Hackensack where a lot of the people in my home group lived, a lot of sober people. And I went to go pick up a sponsee, and we were going to go to lunch and do some step work together. And he lived with like three other guys. And so I walked, it's a beautiful spring day, the door is wide open, and I'm waiting for him outside in the doorway. And I see two guys, a young sponsor sponsoring a new kid, and they're sitting there and they're doing step work together. And I love that. You know, I'm looking and I'm like, all right, you know, these guys are like, they got the big book cracked and they're doing big book work. And I hear him talking to him about 11-step inventory at night. And so he's telling the kid, he says, yeah, so every time you do your inventory at night, he said, I want you to, when you come to the part, do you owe an apology? I want you to write down on an index card what apology you owe, and I want you to use that as your bookmark in your big book when you do pages 84 through 88 every day. And every time you have an apology that needs making, because you do your review at the end of the day, and we're not perfect, and I lied, and I did this, and I did that, I want you to write down what that is and keep it as your bookmark. And every time throughout the next day when you go approach that person and you make the apology, I want you to cross it off. And so I'm listening to this, and I'm like, nobody's ever told me that. I'm sober 6 years, this kid's sober 8 months, and he's sponsoring kids. And I said, hey, who told you that? And he was like, my sponsor told me to do it. And he said, because I found that I was like not making apologies as I'm going along. I write it in my inventory, but that's where it stayed. And it just stayed in my inventory notebook. But I wasn't going out. And I'd forget, or I wouldn't see the person. And before you know it, weeks and months would go by. And I've got like 12 things that I became aware I needed to address, but I wasn't addressing them. So my sponsor said to do this so he could check my index card to make sure I'm staying current. And I said, dude, that's phenomenal. And the kid, like, he thought I was going to tell him, like, you're not supposed to be doing that. I was like, thank you so much. And he's looking at me like, wow. Like, he was somehow shocked that me, Richie, who sponsors all the people in Ridgefield Park. But I said, dude, you just helped me so much. I still do it to this day. I still write that index card because I was forgetting to make a lot of those 10-step apologies myself. And I need to stay accountable, and that's how I stay accountable. And I tell that story because we're about to embark on this. Always remain teachable. You know, there's so many little nuanced things that we can pick up on that we can learn from each other. That's why I like to go to these weekends, why I do big book studies, because maybe somebody's got an angle or a thing they do that may help me grow spiritually, that'll help me stay safe and protected, and most importantly, help me to stay connected with God, because that's what this stuff is really all about. This stuff, this AA program, the main goal is to clear away all the junk that blocks you from accessing a power greater than yourself that can take you beyond where you are and remove the problem. That's the goal. That's what AA has to offer, right? Anybody who doesn't like the God thing or whatever, you know, just my sponsor's family patted me on my head and said, you just keep coming. You know, because that's what this program is really about. And you don't have to have some faith in God to move forward in this stuff. It'll come. Maybe in time. And so, what I'm going to do with you guys tonight, and one more little stage setter that I'll do, came out of this weekend that I was at, interestingly. Do you ever, when you do a big book study or somebody's going to come speak on something, and I'm just going to use, the guy said it, he didn't mean this to do this, but it occurred to me as he did it. He read the second step, and this is what he said. He said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And he highlighted the word could. Could actually, right? You could add the word actually. Could actually restore us to sanity. And I realized, you know, that's interesting. Because if I read that second step out loud, I could read it like this. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we can have two totally different one-hour meetings on the second step, whether I highlight the word could or I highlight the word restore, or if I highlighted the word sanity itself. If I read it again and highlighted sanity, we could have a whole different meeting. And every one of these steps, I could highlight one word and it would change everything we talk about. And the reason is because of my perspective. It's simply a matter of I'm leaning a particular importance on this particular bent, on this word, on this consideration for tonight. With the power I have today, the way I'm currently looking at it based on my current experience. And I'm going to share all the stuff that whatever comes tonight, you know, that I'm going to speak on. And I'll remind everyone that if you hear me talk about the same stuff I read tonight 3 years from now, it's probably going to be different. Because my experience is going to change and so will all of yours. So I always try and remain teachable and I always remember that this is based on mine and your current experience, whatever we get out of a big book study. I think that's kind of cool. So, what I picked tonight, where I picked to at least start reading, and I'm not going to read every word out of the chapter. I'm going to kind of bounce around a little bit just to kind of go over some of the salient points and some cool stuff that kind of sticks out for me. The chapter 9 on page 122 in the big book is The Family Afterward. And the very first sentence, I hate. And it makes me super uncomfortable, and I never liked it even 25 years ago when I read it. I'm like, oh my God, that sounds terrible. Something out of the 30s and 40s. Guess what? That's what it was back then. They were in the 30s and 40s. And so to people who are working with sponsees, when you go to read The Family Afterward, little tact and common sense goes a long way when you're working with folks. I happen to sponsor a few women over the years that have asked me to take them through the steps, and I've done that. And when I read this Family Afterward, especially to the wives, oh my God, that's a whole nother debacle that I don't want to get into. I purposely am going to avoid that chapter right now. But, you know, because of where Bill was at the time when he wrote it, and his wife was supposed to write it, but he was an egomaniac. But anyway, the language was language they used of the day. And I wonder if any of the women here read this and get closed off right away when you read this first thing. It can happen. Human nature, right? I wouldn't like it, right? So if it says, our women folk have suggested certain attitudes a wife may take with her husband who is recovering, right? Our women folk. I mean, come on, really? But they purposely haven't changed any of the language of the big book because it's helped so many people. Once you go down that road of making changes, the belief is that it could get... But guess what? When I sponsor people, I don't use those terms. You can't make me say that. You can't make me read it that way. I use common sense and I adjust what I do as I'm sitting with the people that I'm talking to. And so I say, our family members our family members, because this is the family afterwards, have suggested a certain attitude a wife or a husband or a son or a mom or a daughter might take towards the husband or the wife or the daughter. And I make sure they know this is about everybody, because we're all different. We all have different, and depending on when you got sober. I got sober, I was 26 years old, 25 and a half years old. I didn't have kids. My parents had thrown me out of the house. They wouldn't even let me in for quite some time. So when I got out of detox and I first started getting sober, they didn't even care what I was doing. They didn't care if I was, well, they probably cared if I was alive. But I didn't have that experience, whereas many sponsees of mine, or depending on where you're at when you go through this, you might have gone back to the husband and the kids, or you might have gone back to your mom and dad, or you might have been back to your wife and the kids. And if you do, there's dynamics at play right away. The years of living with an alcoholic or an addict can ruin. It's a ruinous experience depending on how much torture we put them through. And they have to be understanding of us, but we also have to be understanding of them. And that's a difficult dynamic. Difficult. And we're going to talk about those dynamics and how hard it is to practice spiritual principles at home. More so than it is out in the road with strangers. Which it shouldn't be that way. And yet human nature dictates that it is. And so I'll read the first paragraph just because it sets the stage for the rest, and then I'll jump around. Perhaps they created the impression that he or she is to be wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Successful readjustment means the opposite. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. Good luck with that. That is easier read than done. This involves a process of deflation. The alcoholic or addict and his wife and his children, his in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitudes towards himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. We find the more one member of a family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. And that sounds to me like family life. That back and forth, and that when you're reintroduced back into, you're not drinking, you're actually paying attention now to what's going on in the dynamic in the family, and there's a lot of discomfort that can come from all of that. And guess what? People who've been sober for a while, it's no different. Don't tell me that people in here have never fallen into, that have been doing this a while, that you've never fallen into untreated alcoholism. I mean, I find that hard to believe because there's not a JC in the room, I wouldn't imagine. I have fallen into many times, and sometimes for longer than I'd care to admit, untreated alcoholism, where living with me is actually quite difficult. And what I bring to the table and what I'm getting back, and each person trying to jostle for position, and our needs aren't being met, and so we lash out. And this is all the dance. And when there's only one person in the house living on spiritual, trying to practice spiritual principles, and the other person isn't. I don't know if anybody's in that family dynamic. Can't tell you how many times the significant other would look at me and go, maybe you should write some of your inventory. And you're like, geez, I hate when they say that. You know what I mean? Maybe you should write inventory. And then it becomes like a thing. And this book all speaks to the stuff they showed us early on when we first start going through this process. Here it is. It says, and why? Is it, see if this sounds familiar to any of you. Is it not because each wants to play the lead? Is not each trying to arrange the family show to his or her liking? Is he or she not unconsciously trying to see what they can take from family life rather than to give? Does that sound familiar to anybody who does know the book? Because it is familiar. Because if you turn back to page 58 and you first start doing the third step, actually it's on page 60, when you first start doing the third step, they call that the third step exercise. And when you're at the third step, they talk about the first requirement is that we be convinced that our life run on self-will cannot be successful. And this is what they say. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his or her own way. And that's what they're talking about. But now, that was early days. They're giving you a heads up. You're about to turn your will and life over to this magic power that might take you beyond where you are. Has it? By the time you get to the family afterward, it's understood you're already making amends. That you're already doing 10-step work and 11-step work. And they told you early on, you got to stop acting like that. It's no good. and they go on through the rest of the paragraph and saying that, you know, our traits vary, but usually the show doesn't come off well and things end disastrously. Now in the family afterward, those thoughts, those ideas, those concepts that they introduced us to in the third step, consideration, before we've even done any real work or tried to get actually sober, now how do you do with actually practicing the concept we introduced in the third step? Now how do you do in the real world? How you doing in real life with that? Newcomer who's just starting this, probably you're faltering a little and you're struggling, as you should, because you're human and you're going to grow and get better. How about people who've been here for a while? I have to constantly ask myself, you know, that spot check, that daily spot check, where am I with this stuff today? A good step study should make you uncomfortable to one degree or another, I think. Even as I read these words to myself, I'm thinking to myself, how am I doing today with my kids? And I try and always ask myself this, how am I doing with my ex-wives? You know, I can, whew. And so, you know, they say, and I'll read this just as one sentence for the newcomer, cessation of our drinking is only the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. So once you put away the alcohol or whatever your thing was, and now you get back into living, it's a highly strained abnormal condition and it doesn't go away overnight. There's no magic wand. Alcoholics Anonymous has never worked that way that I'm aware of. We are not driven white as snow and we are not saints and we do struggle. And that's why they lay all this stuff out so we can grow along spiritual lines, which is the main point of what the big book is trying to get us to do. If you skip over to page 123, a few paragraphs down, it says, Father knows he is to blame. It may take him many seasons of hard work to be restored financially. Doesn't happen overnight. Now, they bounce around. They go from talking about emotions and feelings, and then they start talking about finances. Finances is a big part for a lot of us. Did anybody here other than me struggle with finances when you first came into Alcoholics Anonymous? Because I certainly did. Does anybody even in recovery struggle with finances? I certainly did at different points and at different ways in my recovery. And they go on to say, we shouldn't be reproached. Good luck with that as well. Perhaps he or she will never have much money again. But the wise family will admire him for what he is trying to be rather than for what he is trying to get. It says, now and then the family will be plagued by specters from the past. For the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny, humiliating, shameful, and tragic. The first impulse will be to bury these skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door. You've heard that before too in different ways. And one of the terms they use, which this is just a different way of saying, I do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. That's just another way of saying that. I don't regret the past, nor do I wish to shut the door on it, right? For people like us, we can't do that. And when it comes to the family, I don't know. I don't know if everybody's family life was like mine. And if it is, you identify, you don't compare. My family wasn't big on talking about your feelings. My father didn't care what you felt. Right? If I wanted to talk to my father about my feelings, this is just for me, my father would say, shut up, Mary! He'd call me Mary. You know what I mean? If I did anything that wasn't manly enough for him, right? So I was not in tune with being able to discuss my feelings. I wasn't in tune with being able to examine these things, to look back. Those things are meant to be buried deep and not brought up again. But we've now done fourth step work. And now we've done an honest fifth step, hopefully. Now I started writing a little bit of inventory and I've started watching how my sickness in my fourth step worked its way out into the world. And I don't want to live like that anymore. So it requires change. And so now I'm trying to change that in my day-to-day living by doing some of these spiritual designs. How well are each of us doing with that spiritual design and with that work? Because if you're not, and you're introduced to these ideas in recovery and you're supposed to be following this direction and that, and we don't follow those directions, do you think you're going to get well by osmosis? My experience is that I do not. When I put down inventory and I'm no longer self-introspection, I'm no longer looking to see where I'm falling short or where I'm growing, when I'm not doing that stuff, I get sick again. And my fourth step, my sponsor said to me in the beginning, and he said it in the fourth step, and he said it when we got to the 11th step inventory in the evenings. My sponsor said, if you're not seeing your character defects and your insanity in black and white, you're going to be seeing it in living color for the rest of your life. And I like that. That resonates with me. And I agree with it. That's been my experience. If I'm not following the directions and taking the action consistently. Now, if I want to do it every once in a while, you can expect to be okay every once in a while. And if you want to do it a little more than every once in a while, maybe you can expect that you're going to have a better experience more consistently. And yet, I still find myself sometimes not writing inventory, not reading 84 through 88, all the things my sponsor said, if I do all these things every day, I'm going to feel and I'm going to get better. One of the things I don't want to actually skip over too quickly, and for some reason I thought I was under the illusion that... I was under the illusion that the next paragraph continued to talk about the financial problems. And I don't want to skip over that too quickly. In the sake of a step study, and again, I asked the question, did you struggle financially when you first came in? And then with some recovery, does any of us struggle financially with finances? And sometimes that can be a deep hole and it can last for a very long time. And it looks different when you first come in than when you're sober for a while. So do amends, so do a lot of different things. And so I'll share with you guys an experience for when I first got sober. And when I first got sober, and in my house, this is back in the mid-90s, there were no cell phones, there was no text messages, we didn't even have an answering machine at my house at this point. I don't know when answering machines came out, my parents might have been late to that party, but we had one of those rotary phones on the wall that had the really long cord so you can go in another room, like a really long cord. And so when I was out there and I was drinking and I caused so much financial havoc that I had creditors calling me day and night. Constantly. My father was so angry because he would constantly be getting calls. Richard Hessian, and his name was also Richard Hessian. Oh my God. So he hated me because they thought he was me, and oh my God, it was a nightmare. And so they would call me, and it got to a point where now in early recovery, I just started going through the steps. And now I'm like home more, and I'm actually there to hear the phone ringing, and I'm not high, and I'm not drunk, and I'm not off God knows where. Now I'm actually there, and I'm picking up the phone, and these guys are like, Richard Hessian, you owe us, and I'm like, oh, and I hang up the phone, because I couldn't, and now when the phone rings, I'm like this, you know what I mean? And my whole family is like, they're attacking us, and it's constantly coming in from the outside, and that's super uncomfortable in early recovery, that constant phone ringing, and them. And so after a while, you learn the little tricks of the trade. And if you're new, I'll just give you one of the tricks. So what I would do, my friends would call. Well, now there's caller ID, so you know who not to pick up. But back then, my friends would call the house. And I'd answer the phone, and I'd pick it up, and I'd go. And just blow into the receiver. And if it was one of my friends, they'd be like, Dick, it's not a collector. What's up? I'd be like, oh, yeah, what's going on? So you blow into the receiver, and my friends knew what that meant. And so they would say, it's me. But a collection agent would be like, hello, hello. And then you just hang up the phone. And so I had these little tricks that I did and that I employed. And then I got up to my amends. And once I got up to my amends, my sponsor, we went and I didn't have any money. I was just getting sober. I got no dough. I can't pay anybody back. I owed $30,000, which back then might as well be 100 right now. Might as well be a million, really, because I was unemployable. So I told my sponsor, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm like, I can't, you know what I mean? I'm not going to be able to actually pay anybody back anything. I don't even have a job yet. And my sponsor, well, I was working, but I didn't have any money yet. And so my sponsor said, he said, it doesn't matter. He said, you're going to have an honest conversation with your creditors and you don't have to avoid those calls anymore. And I was like, foreign idea, but okay. He said, when they call, you're going to pick up and you're going to say, yes, it's me. And yes, I know I owe you money. And yes, I want to make it right. And right now I'm not in a position to do that. But this is the correct phone number and this is my address and this is where I'm at. And give me your name and number. And as soon as I can make any kind of a payment, I'll start going on a payment plan with you. And I'll never forget the freedom that came from that. The freedom of owning up to it and just picking up the phone and talking to a creditor and saying, yes, this is Richard Hessian. And the guy, I love their reactions. They'd be like, oh, they didn't even know what to say because I was on the dead list. They sold me off. My debt had been charged off so long ago, they probably paid half a cent on the dollar. I was one of those unrecoverables that they're never going to get. As soon it would have been disappeared forever. And I told my sponsor, I'm like, yeah, but that's going to go away forever. Can't I just do bankruptcy? He's like, well, you could, or you could get sober. And I'm like, all right, I guess I'll have to own up. The freedom that came from accepting those phone calls and the phone stopped being scary. Every time they'd call, I'd be like, Joe, how are you? Yes, yes, Chevy Chase Bank, I got it, man. I know I owe you the dough. I'm just not quite there yet, and blah, blah, blah. And by funny enough, my dad watched me because he let me live home again, which was a miracle in and of itself, and he watched me doing that process. And after the first few times, he came to me and he said, tell the guy to hold on a second. And I said, hold on a second. And I said, what? And my father said, ask him how much he would, bottom line, he would do to make it go away. And I was like, Pop, you know, and he said, no, you're going to pay me back, but let's get rid of all these debts. And I called my sponsor. I'm like, can I do that? And my sponsor said, yeah, the big book says make the best deal you can. He said, you're not even paying the original creditor. He's like, they won't let you pay them back. They've already charged all that off. So if you can make a deal with the guy and they're willing to do a deal to make it go, make the best deal you can. See what they say. And so I said, well, what's the best deal you could offer me? And $30,000 in credit card debt became $3,000 in credit card debt. All of them forgave it. My father paid it all. And then I had to pay him. You got my money? Give me my $50. And I had to pay my dad. But that's the actual process. That's the family afterward. That's the these words coming off the page in real life. Like, where does the rubber actually meet the road? It wasn't comfortable. I didn't wait until I saved up enough money that I could just make it all disappear. It doesn't work that way. It's that's the deflation that they're talking about. Deflation of ego. I had to be able to say, yes, I screwed up and I can't make it right now, but I'd like to and I'm willing to, and let's figure out a way to make that work, and what's that going to look like? That's where the rubber meets the road. Now, fast forward years later, people who are struggling in recovery, it's a lot easier for me, maybe other people identify, it's easier for me in the early day stuff when I make mistakes and I screw up and I owe an apology, when I can kind of directly blame it on my alcoholism and my addiction. And so when I have to own up and fess up to stuff I've done in recovery, it's a lot more difficult. Ego reemerges, but it comes from the left instead of the right. And the ego is still there, and ego is even bigger attached to that, especially if you're sober now and you sponsor people and you're not supposed to have financial difficulties. Bullshit. You're not supposed to have financial. It's ridiculous. I would not go to my home group and raise my hand and say I'm struggling with X, Y, or Z because I sponsor 20 people and I speak all over the place, so I'm not supposed to be sick in that way. And that mentality can embed itself in many of us. And what a shame that is, because that's just ego reemerging. It's harder, the mistakes we make in recovery, than it was for the built-in excuse that we had back in the day. That's been my experience. Before we move on, has anybody else had that experience? Did anybody else agree with that? Does anybody else find that in your personal experiences? Anytime we do big book studies, I know after it'll go for a little bit, but I like to at least call on some people here or there just to see. Does anybody else identify with any of that? And that's why I like to go to the, is it just this idiot up front saying it, or have other people in the room actually had the experiences, right? And many of us have, right? And that's part of the recovery game. That's part of the gig. And the financial stuff, I don't tell the story often. I just don't. There's people in my recovery group that, when I was getting sober, they don't like to talk about the cash and prizes, they would say. The cash and prizes aren't important. You just got to do the work. And, you know, you don't want to highlight with the newcomer the cash and prizes. But I don't know. I like the cash and prizes that come with recovery. You know what I mean? Because recovery, there comes cash and prizes. You know what I mean? You do the next right thing, and for the sake of doing it. Actually, you know what? And I know this is coming up, so I'm going to hold off on that because there'll be a place where we can discuss the cash and prizes where it would be better suited. So I'm going to move on from this other than to say, don't ever forget that all of us, you are not alone. And if you've already gotten to this point, if you've not gotten to this point yet and you've not shared a fifth step yet, this is what they're talking about. And the fifth step, when we write our fourth step in our deep, dark secrets, we've all had escapades that are humiliating, shameful, and tragic. All of us. All of us have had them. If it's got a name, it's been done, and probably by me. We all have stuff that we wish we could just never have happened in the first place. But, you know, wish as you might, it happened. Usually it's not a secret. Usually at least one other person knows anyway. In my experience, usually at least one other person's aware anyway of the worst stuff that we're scared to say out loud or that we don't want to see the light of day. It's that stuff that'll kill you. And they re-bring that up throughout the program of recovery. They warned you in 80 ways till Sunday leading up to your fifth step not to withhold anything. Now here they are once again reminding us all we've all had that stuff. Shameful, tragic. You know, it's so funny. People think that they missed the opportunity and, oh, now what can I do about it? I know people who for years in recovery went on to sponsor people and live a sober lifestyle and still struggled with that thing inside that they never told their sponsor on the fifth step. For years it was there eating away at them. And then somebody gave them the silly consideration of, you know, you can still share that like right now. There's no reason in the world for you to continue walking around with that garbage. Just throw it out. I was lucky. I happened to fall into a home group of people who were the sickest human beings that I've ever met on Staten Island, because it's not a hotbed of mental health there. And Tattoo Larry, God rest his soul, came up to me one day when I was about to share my fifth step. And Tattoo Larry came up and said, hey, Richie, I see that you look scared to death. He's like, aren't you going to be sharing your fifth step with Joey T? And I said, yeah, because we all knew what was going on with everybody's steps. And I said, yeah, I'm about to do it. I said, we're doing it this weekend. And he's like, man, you look scared. He goes, come out to the parking lot for a second. And he goes, Mike McCarty, Kevin, come out in the parking lot for a second. So they three guys from my home group walked out into the parking lot away from everybody. And Larry goes, McCarty, tell him the worst thing on your fifth step. And he just told me somehow. These guys, Larry started talking about peanut butter with his dog and his privates. Oh my God, it was fucking horrifying. I was horrified by it. And now I'm listening to these guys and I'm like, oh my God, like that's horrible. And at the end of each one was worse than the next, because these guys were a collection of misfit toys. And I'm listening to them and I'm like, oh my God. And all of a sudden, my fear of sharing my fifth step was gone. Because we've all had experiences that are humiliating, shameful, and tragic. And all of a sudden, mine didn't seem quite so bad. And that's the power. They were free. They were free of their worst things. And they could say it to another human being in a parking lot of a church because he's struggling and they knew that it could help get me free. And that's power. Imagine having that power to no longer have those things weigh you down anymore, where you could actually easily share them with another human being because it can help take them beyond where they are. That's the power of God. And that's astounding to have that kind of shield and power that you no longer walk around with that fear. Don't ever let that stuff stay in. If it's got a name, it's been done, and probably by me. It's my favorite. All right, so if we turn to the next page, just, I'll point this out anytime we're together in the next few weeks. Anytime I see it in the book, I underline it and I'll point it out to you guys. The very last sentence in the very top little paragraph, reading it out of context doesn't matter. It says, centered and in direct conflict with the new way of living. It says that in this book so many times, way of life, way of living, lifestyle. Unbelievable how many times they refer to all of this as a way of living. Because that's what this is. This is not a thing to go from A to Z and then you're finished. This is a lifestyle. They've crafted a way of some spiritual guideposts, which you're never going to perfectly follow, but you try and stay within the spiritual guideposts. Or on page 124, in case you guys were looking for it, in the very top paragraph, the little mini paragraph up there, the last word, three words in that little paragraph is way of living. And it's important. That is in this book a lot. Way of living, way of life. Constant. Just a reminder for us. This is not just a thing we do. It's actually a lifestyle. I love this next sentence. It's always been meaningful to me, and it's about people with time. I don't value time in the same way other people do. I just celebrated on October 24th, 25 years. And that's pretty cool, right? XXV, I got the coin in my pocket. I like it. It's all good. You know what I had the day after my 25th years? 25 years in one day. So what? Right? I've got one day. I've got today. In the now. Nothing I can do about yesterday or yesteryear. They're gone. And what's going to come tomorrow, it's promised to no one. What I do have, like Eckhart Tolle style, I'm not going to go too deep, but stay in the now. Right? Appreciate and be in the day. Today. This is what we all have together. The efforts and the results and things that we're doing today. What am I doing for my recovery today? Having said that, what does this next sentence say? Henry Ford, who was a very wise man, once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of extreme value in life. And I wrote, experience is the thing of supreme value in an AA meeting. And that's what time does. It doesn't matter that somebody has 25 years and 8 days or whatever you've got. What matters is if they've been living the big book, that's a lot of mistakes that that person's probably made and overcome to still have their chair in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the people in the room that do have some time put together, I seek them out. I want to discuss with them because I know they've probably screwed everything up 8 ways till Sunday and can probably share with me some of their experience on living this way of living this lifestyle. And if you don't have people in your life with more recovery time than you or more time practicing this, you should get some. Because they can add a lot of experience and depth and weight to the experience that you've had or are having up until now. And it's invaluable. And so I think it's important, and so it's worth saying. If you skip down now to the end of the next paragraph, it's the last few sentences says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Maximum service to God and His kids. And again, it's just another thought that we've already covered, which is like that fifth step stuff, right? It's the, you know, the things that you were always scared of and the things that always owned you, you can actually take mastery over them to use them to help another human being. And there's a lot of power in that. The next thing was, if you skip over to page 125, a couple of paragraphs down, it says, Another principle we observe carefully, and I love when they talk about principles. There's lots of principles we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. It's called the spiritual law of consent, or direct consent. The story I told you guys about Tattoo Larry and the dog thing, he told me I am specifically allowed to share that any time that I think it would be helpful to another alcoholic, including and especially when we do big book studies. I've told that story on Larry countless times over the years. He insisted on it because he said, I know that can help to shed some fears the way it did for you that day in the parking lot. Having said that, if you've not gotten direct spiritual consent for someone to share something they've shared with you, either in confidence on a fifth step, you damn well better never repeat that, even one-on-one. And that's one of the big key principles in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've seen some ruinous stuff happen, and just put it out in your regular life. Please, don't tell me anybody in here hasn't done that either, because I know I have. Listen, I'm going to tell you something, but don't tell anybody else. This is serious. This is just between me and you. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Betty Rothberg, did you hear what happened at work? And then you tell the little story. And then it's also kind of like, well, this is kind of like a 10th step in a way, because I'm just sharing with you with the spiritual idea behind it. And then that person goes to somebody else and says, listen, I'm going to tell you something, but don't say anything to anyone else. And no one tells anybody else except one person. And before you know it, everybody knows. And we have a very grave responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, I don't know why the fifth step thing keeps coming up, but you know, when we do these things, it happens for a reason. I was scared to death after I shared my fifth step, and I told you I was scared that night, and they shared all that stuff, and I shared my fifth step with Joey T. Joey T went out and relapsed. 5 months later, my sponsor was gone, and I told him everything. He's from my neighborhood, drank at the bars that I drank at. And before I shared the fifth step, that was one of my fears. He didn't have a lot of time when he started doing sponsorship work with me. And I was scared of that. And I went to Tattoo Larry afterwards, and I'm like, now Joey went out and actually relapsed. And so he was like, okay. He said, so? And I was like, well, what if he goes and tells everybody my fifth step stuff? And he goes, what if he does? Are you free of it? And I hadn't actually thought about it. And I sat and I said, yeah, I guess I really don't care if he tells everybody. And that's amazing for a kid like me. I didn't realize it, that I became like one of them in the parking lot. Where I just didn't really care. Turns out Joey T didn't tell anybody about the fifth step stuff, and Joey T went to California, relapsed for 10 years, tried to kill himself in his house, was blown out the back door when he set the stove on fire, and got blown literally out his back door, called me 2 days after that occurrence from California, came back up here, and asked me if I would sponsor him. And he's now a sponsee with 12 years of recovery. That's astounding stuff. That's where the rubber meets the road in this stuff. And it's something we won't read in the book, but you've heard in AA meetings before. Be nice to your sponsees, because one day they may be your sponsor. Have you ever heard that before? It's pretty cool, right? Okay, this is the part. So if you go down to the last little paragraph there on 125, it says, many alcoholics are enthusiasts. They run to extremes. Identify. At the beginning of recovery, a man or a woman will take, as a rule, one of two directions. He or she may either plunge into a frantic attempt to get on your feet in business, or you may be so enthralled with your new life that you talk or think of little else. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we have had experience galore. And so I already did discuss that, right? Which was throwing yourself, you can throw yourself into the spiritual lifestyle too much, as well as concentrating on getting your business back and getting money again because now you're sober. Both things are unhealthy. And we see people come in and do both of those things. What they're asking us to try and pull off in early recovery is something that most of us have a difficult time with. And it's one big word that's very heavy, that weighs me down and can crush me like a grape. And that word is balance. I don't do balance. I've never been able to pull off balance. I either go all in, or many of us have had that experience. Some people... Oh, wow. It goes fast, doesn't it? Holy cow. I did that on purpose because I know now that I only have 5 minutes. Some people find balance to be a mystery and very difficult to achieve, right? Whereas other people in areas of alcoholism or otherwise, they find it difficult. But in other areas of their life, they actually do have balance. I don't have that experience. And so I'll share with you that mine is that I find it hard to have balance in many things. Balance doesn't come naturally to me. And so it's an acquired skill, like practicing a piano. And with God's help and the sponsor's help and some of the other tools they've given us, I've been able to achieve and find some balance in my spiritual life. Although, again, it's not something that comes naturally to me. And in some ways, it's very difficult. But some people come in and they work like I did. My experience was I worked too much with people in the beginning. And, you know, if you're going to give one of the two, I'll take having somebody working with way too many sponsees. That's not so bad. But when you come in and you start throwing yourself into work or business, what about not just when you first come in? What about now in recovery and later life in recovery? Aren't we supposed to always be looking for balance in our life? Is it possible that some of us work way too much? We've had a 12-step experience. Just saying, maybe. Some people might have a 12-step experience, sponsored people at one point, but then you're just too busy. I can't. I don't have time to sponsor people right now. I've got a business, and I've got my kids, and I've got all this stuff going on, and I just can't make time for that right now. At some point I will, but it's nonsense, right? It's nonsense. That's the thing that keeps us sober. Working with others and sponsoring people is the spiritual currency. And when all other measures fail, work with another alcoholic will save the day. That's a huge statement. What does "when all other measures" mean? When all other measures fail, what other measures are they talking about? What other measures are there? Inventory? Prayer? Talking to a sponsor? Going to meetings? Those are a lot of measures that we try and do to stay sober. But when all those other measures aren't connecting and you're still in a rough spot, work with another alcoholic is going to save the day. My sponsees have saved me 10 times over. I love when they're like, oh, Richie, and you helped me so much. And I'm like, they saved my life. My sponsees saved my life. Working with them is what's kept me safe and protected for all these years. And they're under the illusion that I'm doing something for them. I sit down, I read from a book, they either follow the directions or they don't. They save my life. I love my sponsees for that. And so the way I'm going to close this one out is with a final story. And again, because of the cash and prizes, and because this power that we've found is so huge and beyond me, and so beyond what I thought, Has anybody ever asked you for the exercise, the mental exercise, the spiritual exercise when you were early days? My sponsor did. And he said, just picture where you would see yourself 5 years from now. Just take a second and think about 5 years from now, where do you see yourself? And so I sat there and I considered and I thought about it. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like going high, you know what I mean? Like I'm going to have a car, you know, and I'm going to have a bank account. And I'm not going to owe money to anybody. And I'm going to, all these things I put for myself and my sponsor. At the end of the exercise, I said, oh, what did you, and I told him the things that I, where I could see myself and I would have a job and whatever. And my sponsor laughed and he said, whatever you would have said, you're selling yourself way short. Because what you get from this is power beyond measure. And he said, anything you can see yourself, I'm telling you that you can go a lot higher if you're open, honest, and willing to try. If you're willing to put this stuff to practice in your real life. And I'll tell you, for me, I did not, I told you I threw myself heavy into working with sponsees, not work. And I needed the money and I needed to get a job and I was underwater. And I told my sponsor, I gotta, my friends all graduated school, all my friends that I grew up with who went to law school. I'm a dropout, right? I'm unemployable. I got an arrest record. I've got no credit. I have no shot at any kind of a real job. My friends, who's bought a house, who's getting married, who has kids, who graduated law school. And me, I'm a wreck. I'm a bum. And so I told my sponsor, I gotta keep it moving, man. I gotta do stuff. I gotta make moves. And my sponsor said, no, you don't gotta do any of that. What you gotta do is concentrate on doing the next right thing and helping other alcoholics. And all those other life problems, you know, like put all your problems in the basket by the door. It's true. If you put all your life problems in a basket by the door and you work on yourself spiritually and follow these directions, little by slowly, all those things just start writing themselves. And my sponsor said, I promise you that that's going to happen for you. And because we don't have time, I'm coming back next week. And please remind me, if anybody who is here next week, that this is where we left off. Because the story of what happened to me, my life has been a movie since I've come to this place. I was unemployable. And the things that have occurred, the miracle, the cash and prizes, the stuff that's gone on in my life is literally impossible. It's been like a movie. It's absolutely beyond my wildest imagination, the things that have occurred to me in recovery. And not all of it good. But here I am. So that's it for this week. And now we'll go around, right? Cool? Great. Let's do it.